Hi, my name is Christine Huskisson, and I am one of the co-owners of Warp Weft Productions, which produces an online publication titled Undermain. I am here with Louis Zoller-Bickett. Welcome, Louis.
Oh, thank you.
I am so happy that you've agreed to this interview. Honored to be here with you today, because for many, you are considered one of the most prolific, inventive, and unique artists, not only for your many artistic endeavors that you engage, but from my point of view, for your perseverance and your dedication to your artistic practice. I'd like today to talk a little bit about the construction of a couple of your projects, including The Archive, which you've been dedicated to for over 40 years, and how that examines identity. So a good place to start is, tell us who you are.
I'm Louis Zoller-Bickett II. I was born in Clark County in Winchester, Kentucky in 1950. Went to the local Catholic school there, St. Agatha Academy. And, I had an identity as an artist through the encouragement of mainly my mother, but also the nuns that taught me at, from a very early age. And that's sort of common when you get to talking to artists about, you know, what influenced you, what caused you to do this. You hear that a lot, that it starts in childhood. I showed some natural ability, I suppose you would say, in drawing and painting, and I was very interested in it and interested in music as well. So I was encouraged, and, you know, like a lot of kids do, won ribbons and awards from the school, and that's what really did it for me. And unlike most kids that are, you know, do garage bands or art, I just didn't stop. I've had an uninterrupted art production since I was a senior in 1968, 69. Then around 1970, I got very, very interested in it, doing it every day, sometimes working 8-12 hours a day. And I started being really interested in photography about 1970. And I remember exactly when it was, 1972, my mother was sitting in the family kitchen and she was going through a very large box of family photographs. And in that box were photographs from every era of photography, from its invention in 1839, up into that point in the 70s. And she was doing a really curious thing. If the photographs or the ambrotypes or the daguerreotypes were notated and she knew who they were, she put them in one pile. And if she didn't know who they were, if they were just a printed photograph, she ripped them into. And of course, in the early 70s, photography as a, you know, vintage family photography as a collection, things weren't worth anything. You could buy a daguerreotype for a dollar in an antique shop, and I bought many of them. And I asked her what she was doing. She said, "Well, I don't know who these people are." And I asked her if I could have them. And so she stopped, you know, having the pile on the left and the pile on the right. And she gave them to me. And then I started cataloging them and arranging them, even if I didn't know them. And some of the people I didn't know, I would make up these little short narrative stories about them. And that's really how the archive, what has come to be known as the archive, Louis Zoller-Bickett, that's what really started it. And it went through many incarnations, depending on my not only ability to produce this archive, but to understand what an archive was, and also my ability to pay for it. It started out in binders that you would buy at, you know, the corner dime store or drugstore that were very non-archival. And it probably was Arturo Sandoval, a friend of mine that was an influence on my career. When I met him in 1982, I remember him looking at the binders and saying, "Oh, these are not archival. You need to change these. In your lifetime, these color photographs will turn to nothing if you don't." So I started putting them in archival pages. And the same way with the way I store the archive, there are about 600 archive boxes of documented and archived material in the archive. And that went from wine boxes, you know, beer boxes, common corrugated cardboard boxes, to archive boxes. So it sort of morphed and changed over the years to where I had the archive department at the University of Kentucky look at it, and they said, oh, this is in remarkable shape. Everything is clean. It's orderly. And the archive is arranged chronologically, date chronologically. So it's very easy to look anything up because everything also has a computer database, what I call an index, where everything in the archive, in the binders, in the boxes is described. Because I looked up after doing this for about 20 years, and I was looking at a photograph in one of the binders, and I thought, oh, I don't know, I don't remember who this person is. So I thought, oh my, you know, I'll get to the point in older age where some of these memories are going to fade. So I went back and did a computer database, a description of every binder, which was at the time way over 200, and there's probably about 500 binders now. And I described everything and gave a date to everything. And I think that took a little over 2 years to make those indexes. They started out, I said computer database, they actually started out on written, then they went to word processor, and then they went to the computer. And so now I do it by the day. So I don't have to worry about, you know, forgetting or putting it off. It's a very orderly project.
Let's back up just a little. Let's go back up to the other projects that you've done that seem to be self-portrait projects.
Yes.
You have done a number of things called 10,000 Selfies, What I Read, Back Bar, and The Archive. All of these seem to be constructing identity for you.
Right.
Is that true? If so, are you constructing a single identity or multiple identities through these projects?
I really like that question. I've never been asked that before. I think I would, without thinking about it too much, I would think it would be multiple identities. And it's not necessarily my identity. Now, as I've gotten to be an older man, I'll be 66 this year. Auto portraits, when I started doing them about 20 years ago and really seriously digitally 15 years ago, I've done thousands and thousands of them. One section is called 10,000 Auto Portraits. I've done several years where I did one every day, and I'm doing one now every day. And they really are a pain to do. After a little while, you just sort of dread doing it. It's not like when people say, oh, I get so much pleasure out of making my art. It's like, it's not that you can't get pleasure, but if you're having too much fun, you might want to reevaluate what you're doing, because, I mean, like anything that is meaningful, I mean, it's a lot of work, and there's frustration involved with it. And with the self-portraits, when you're doing something like that, there's such a negative connotation, particularly on social media, about the selfie. I personally think the selfie, and I said this to a photographer friend of mine in New York the other day, and he said he thought I was correct. I think the selfie is the most important photographic development since the Polaroid. And it's not a narcissistic endeavor, certainly not for me. I suppose it can be a narcissistic endeavor. But with me, where you're getting older, or you might have the flu, or you don't feel so well, they're not particularly flattering. Some of them can be, I suppose. But, you know, I do them early in the morning, late at night, and you can sort of look like hell.
Do you ever capture an image of yourself or find an object that you would exclude intentionally from any of these portraits?
Well, you know, I am a conceptual artist and an archivist, but I'm also not a journalist. So if the idea of excluding something from what I do, whether it's I'm archiving a gas bill or electric bill, or I'm taking a photograph, I am concerned about, I do concern myself with traditional artistic concerns, like, you know, composition, the color of the photograph, you know, the shape of the electric bill. Is it interesting? Was it particularly large? Is it past due? You know, all those kind of things interest me, and they also tell a story. But in answer to that, I really discard very, very little some really extremely personal things involving the family I don't include, or I do include, but yet I don't scan them to be put on social media or any of the sites. I do a very large body of what I call the sub-archive. I do one for, I've done many for friends. I do one for the mayor of Lexington. And I have an arrangement with them not to really scan them or put them online. And really, in most of them, with the exception of a bunch of letters from an artist friend of mine when she was in Cranbrook, which was vividly describing her sexual escapades at the time, none of them are, there's nothing in any of them that's really what I would call shocking or undesirable. But a lot of people just don't, that knew that I was doing this. And like in the case of Jim Gray, it's scores and scores of volumes, but almost all political stuff. So, you know, it's nothing, there's never anything really what I would call risque in them, but people don't like to have their lives invaded. So,
so let me go then to a question. If you exclude very little from this archive, the archive, what about the three representations of the archive that I know of?
Yes.
The first being, I believe, at Land of Tomorrow, curated by Joey Yates. The second at Institute 193. And the third at Zephyr Gallery, curated by Julian Robeson. The third I'm really interested in.
Yes.
The third being a little more inclusive and referencing process. Mm-hmm. It seemed to reference your process and how you find an object, tag an object, and then display an object in a very orderly fashion. Can you address that exhibition?
Yes. In the case of the shows at the Zephyr Gallery at Institute 193 and at Lot in Louisville, Lot Gallery, Land of Tomorrow, all of those were chosen by the, all the work was chosen by the curator, and I didn't have near the input that you would think I would have or want to have, and I really didn't want to have it because I've designed because of money and space constraints. I've designed all the archive and all the artwork that I've made for the last 25 years, at least 30 years, with a very modular concept. It doesn't really have to be shown one way. The Zephyr show was definitely in Louisville, was curated by Julian Robeson, was definitely the most comprehensive. And his idea was to have the upstairs part of the gallery to show the work in more of what I would call a Chelsea manner. In other words, it was much more minimal and looked like a museum. And the downstairs part looked much more like how my archive or my studio or my living arrangement looks like. And that's what Institute 193, that was curated by Philip March Jones, he did the same thing. And then I had a vignette that was also done, which I don't know if you are familiar with or not, but I had a vignette that was produced at shown at 21C in Louisville. And that was and all of those venues that I've just mentioned, it's remarkable how much they look alike. And people that are really familiar with where I live and the archive, they always say, oh my gosh, it was just like going into your archive. But of course, it can't be just like it because we didn't have windows and doors and things weren't exactly like that. But people that are familiar with the material, they have this impression, which is what we're trying to give them, and I'm glad they do have the impression, that this is exactly like something they had seen before in my house. And I like that. I think that's a nice way to deal with it. As far as the variety of the archive goes, and even with the self-portrait work, it's so varied. At Zephyr Gallery in Louisville, for instance, Julian showed the Epipsodean, I think it was 2003. It's called Back Bar, and there, I sort of predict that I had saved about 80% of my urine output in one year. I mean, I even saved it when I went to New York. I couldn't believe I was able to frame it, mail it back. But wherever I was in the world at that time, I would save the urine and seal it really carefully and mail it back. And then it was archived in 365 liquor bottles from where people look at that project and think I drank the liquor. Well, I wasn't drinking chartreuse and Chambord, so I drank some of the liquor, but not much. They were bottles from where I worked at Olive Lucy restaurant. And then they were all tagged with the date, usually with names of friends of mine, relatives, birth dates or events, things like that. Julian showed those on the floor. That was really, really sort of mysterious, I think. And definitely an auto portrait. I mean, you know, I flippantly say, you know, it's my DNA in there.
That's my question. With Backbar and the project titled What I Read, which is a series of photographs of you reading a number of texts, mm-hmm. this moves from the creation of identity to being very autobiographical, it seems.
Yes.
Could you reference these projects as autobiography and any texts that
sure.
are included?
In the project, What I Read, which Julian enlarged two of them to about 4 foot by 5 foot photographs for the Zephyr Show in Louisville. They're very autobiographical because all of the books depicted, the Quran, the Holy Bible, Philip Roth's book, I Married a Communist, Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, several other, Flaubert's Madame Bovary, Joyce's Ulysses. There are books that I tend to read over and over again. Ulysses I've read 9 times. I read the Quran about 3 times, I think, for a text project and a video project I was working on. I couldn't tell you how many times I've read the Bible. But most of those books are books that were definitely read more than once. Madame Bovary, I've probably read 9 times. So they're very autobiographical in that they tell, you know, what I'm interested in, what literature has done for me or to me. And I'm, you know, in a 3-piece suit, dressed up, wearing my father's Borsellino hat and a bow tie, you know, just very stoically reading these books. I've done the same thing with every T-shirt I own, every tie I own, every long tie I own. So it's not only a documentation and an archive of my possessions, because in the case of the books and the shirts, I own them, still have them. It's a way of showing something about how I engage the world.
So that brings me to maybe a little more sensitive topic, and that is in both the 2009 exhibition at Institute 193 and the 2015 exhibition at Zephyr Gallery, both curators referenced that the final object in your archive would be your own body. And that obviously references death. And if you're comfortable talking about that
sure.
in any regard, I think it would be of interest.
Sure. One of the subcategories of the archive is the obituary project. And also bottles that are archived and sealed and with laminated descriptive tags dealing with garbage, sand, oil, you know, there's motor oil archived in reference to the energy crisis. There's ocean and water, lake samples from around the world. Also, cremated remains of pets. A couple different friends of mine shared the cremains of their husbands, and I've archived those, and I keep one for the archive and give one to the person that donated it. So, yeah, that got me to thinking that, you know, I want to do this with myself. In the case of the obituary project, I've left instructions for my studio assistant, Aaron Skolnick, he knows how to do the labels and how to finish. I have the label already designed. He knows how to put the final date on it. So in the case of the obituaries, the final obituary will be mine. And then the final archive jar will be my cremains. And it will, there'll probably be about, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen cremains before. It's actually a lot of material. I'll probably do about eight different, Aaron will do about eight different jars, which he will distribute to friends and family members. And so the finality of the archive and the project is, I mean, it's really exciting to think that that's how it's going to end, because I remember talking to my friend, my artist friend, Carmen Greer from Pinland, North Carolina, 20 years ago about this project. It's like, oh, my God, Carmen, this is just the biggest pain in my ass. It's so expensive. It's impossible to store it. I don't have the money to do it, but I keep, you know, I've kept it together all these years. She said, well, just stop. She said, you're not a journalist. You don't have to answer to anybody. Just don't do it. So, and I thought, well, you know, I remember telling her, it's like, you know, I sort of feel like that it's almost morally wrong to stop. Even though it's not a moral issue. To me, it was like, you know, if you're writing a diary for the first 50 years of your life and you decide to stop it, it's almost like you're deciding to stop living. So the finality of the project being with my death and the entries about them, I mean, I think it's really, to me, it's almost liberating. I was diagnosed with ALS in December after a year of testing, which almost drove me crazy. And when I got the diagnosis of the ALS, instead of, you know, having to go to pieces, it was like, oh, well, finally, they finally figured this out. This is great. And I realized that I needed to, you know, start putting some finality to these projects, which is what I'm doing.
I'd like, if I could then, to turn to some of the poetry that you have recently written, I believe recently.
Yes.
That seems to focus not only on death, but on childhood, maybe the birth to death cycle.
Right.
And that are now being published with Aikai. And there's one in particular that I thought you might read for us, and title included, please.
Simple gift. Coffee outside. The sun slowly builds strength. It is early. There is little traffic, little sound. Sitting under a large but leafy adolescent tree, a comfortable breeze wraps loosely around me. It could be autumn instead of the end of a dying July that until today baked everything thoroughly done. A bearded man behind me, sitting on an ancient rusting glider, gently moves in time with the music he is making, plucking on a mandolin, a simple gift.
It's emotional. But you've referenced being excited, being
yes.
inspired by it, and even maybe reference to a romantic narrative circling around what seems to be the decay, a natural decay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure the question to ask, other than how do you foresee this influencing the final project in the end, as it might impact the specific region of Lexington, Kentucky, artists in this region, mm-hmm. people that know and care about you, and maybe your ultimate commentary.
Yes. Well, when I was diagnosed with, you know, this sort of really, you know, impactful disease, that whenever you are told that I basically had a timeline of it goes like this. When they figure out what your timeline is, when it started, it's a year to a year and a half. It can be 2 years, and you can be, you know, the 5 to 10% that goes on for a few years. They don't really know. But if it's a year, you know, I'm walking with great difficulty, but I can do a lot. And then you have that for about a year, and then the last 6 months is you're basically in a bed. So how I dealt with that is that I have been an existentialist since I was late teenager. And I felt, you know, if you're a Stoic and you have this onward soldier philosophy about life, that there's nothing wrong with being emotional. But for me, it was not the way that I conduct my daily life. And also, I think a lot of that comes from being a waiter at Lucy's for nearly 30 years, where you're dealing with these, you know, sort of high performance types, and you can, you know, really emotional over it. And it's very touching. but I haven't. So what I plan to do when I got this is that I work on so many dozens of projects at the same time, and they're all listed in the computer and described. And it's not uncommon for me to work on a project for 10 or 15 years. When I got the diagnosis of ALS, I thought, well, I need to pull all this crap together. So I started doing that, and I'm doing that now. And I mean, there are new projects finishing up the old projects, and I've gone about it in a very orderly fashion. The unfortunate part is that fatigue is a very definite, realistic part of the illness. So I sort of walk across the floor, and I need a 2-hour nap. But other than that, I'm really pulling it together, and I'm also doing that with the poetry, which Akwai has so graciously embraced. And that it is poetry based on a manuscript that I've been working on since 1972. It's the craziest thing. I've never heard of anybody that worked on a manuscript this long. And I do really think that it's, I like it. I think it's gotten to be very good and very honest. A lot of it is about me. A lot of it is about the family, certainly about my past, a little bit about the illness, but I'm trying to do that not in a soapy way. And I guess what I want all this work to do, what I want people to get out of the archive or any of the work, or if I publish the manuscript further from the digital publication that Dan Brown is doing in Cincinnati, of the poetry of the manuscript, I really don't have any preconceived notions of what they get out of it. I mean, even if they get nothing out of it, that's what they get. The nothing becomes something. A lot of what I do, there's no right way to do it. I mean, some people read these poems and they get really choked up. It's like, since I'm not a choke up kind of guy, it touches me, but it doesn't surprise me. But whatever they get, that's good.
So with that, I'd like to conclude and really just thank you, Louis, for your time. I'd like to thank you, Neil of Dynamics Productions, and iKai, Daniel Brown, as well as Undermain, where we will be publishing this podcast. Thank you, Louis, for coming.
Oh, thank you so much. This was most enjoyable. I appreciate it.